Okay, please be seated, everyone. We'll call our next case, which is case number 62666, Renown Regional Medical Center versus District Court. Mr. Wiley, real party in interest. We have Mr. Nork for the appellant, Mr. Peterson for the respondent. Justice Pickering has voluntarily recused herself from participation in this particular case. So, Mr. Nork, you may proceed. Did you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Jeremy Nork, and I represent Petitioner Renown Regional Medical Center in this matter. Within months after the underlying case commenced, which was a putative class action against Renown, the parties, in an attempt to save time and money, agreed to test the legal sufficiency of one person's claim under some fairly novel legal theories, under a set of stipulated facts, to see if that plaintiff could go forward in this matter.
Okay, let me ask the first question.
Yes, Your Honor.
When you filed your motion for summary judgment, what were you trying to accomplish? What did you want the judge to rule in your motion for summary judgment? Exactly, what was your prayer? Judge, this is what I need.
What we were seeking, Your Honor, was a dismissal of the plaintiff's case against Renown. It was our view for five separate reasons, that plaintiff did not have a viable claim against Renown.
But you didn't want them to get the extra $6,000 that was at stake here?
Well, Your Honor, I guess it's a little greater scope than that, because this was set forth as a class action. And a class action was defined as all persons who have ever had a hospital lien filed against them where there was a third-party tortfeasor involved. So the concern was not just Mr. Wiley's $6,000, but rather it was the much broader scope of potentially 6 or 7 years worth of potential claimants. So the concern, you know, wasn't just on Mr. Wiley.
And what was your understanding of Judge Adams' ruling as far as in favor of Wiley? What did he actually rule in the summary judgment? That now you filed a petition, because my real question is, when you filed your petition for writ relief, what did you want to accomplish? What did you want this court to accomplish for you?
The court issued an oral order at the conclusion of our oral argument, stating that he was denying Renown's motion for summary judgment on one legal basis. That was the court's order. What has since happened is, using a proposed order prepared by Mr. Wiley's counsel, it has morphed into not just an order denying summary judgment as to Renown on one legal basis, but as to the other four legal bases that were articulated in our pleadings, and a granting of summary judgment in favor of Mr. Wiley on not just two of his claims in his motion for summary judgment, but two additional claims that were never briefed nor argued. So you asked, what did we want changed? Well, the court's original order, we prepared a proposed order that we thought mirrored the court's oral pronouncement at the conclusion of our hearing. And we would have likely appealed that as well. But certainly, the order as it now sits entered bears no resemblance whatsoever to what the court ordered, to what was argued, to what was briefed, to what the stipulated facts were. Nothing, Your Honor. And so the relief we are seeking, I guess, would be twofold. One would be to have, we feel that under the third-party beneficiary provision, as set forth in our briefing, that this court can reverse and dismiss. Barring that, we at least would ask for a remand back for a consideration of the order of the matters that were actually before the court and that were the basis for the court's decision.
Counsel, within this whole argument, we had this little argument bubbling up about reasonable value of services, where there was a discount provision between the hospital and an insured, and the issue of whether or not that has any other application, where the hospital was willing to settle for a smaller amount, but later says we're still entitled to the full amount. And the position of Renown is that should not be given any consideration, that once Renown throws a number out there, that number stands in perpetuity, without even an evaluation about reasonableness in light of Renown's willingness to compromise it based on contract or otherwise.
Well, That's a valid point, Your Honor, but I guess on one hand, Cigna and Renown contracted for the discounted amount. And in exchange, there's a business relationship between those two entities about referrals of patients and about providing medical services. But the person who was paying the full amount was not a Cigna insured. Rather, it was the person who ran into Mr. Wiley. He was the third-party tortfeasor.
But don't you indirectly set the bar once you're willing to discount it at that rate? Don't you then define what is reasonable because you're willing to do that?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think the case law supports our position. First of all, there is a distinction, I think, between reasonable charges and reasonable value. And I think the case law that we have cited both distinguishes some of the California case law cited by respondent, but it identifies reasonable value being different than reasonable charges.
But that issue all by itself go back to be re-litigated, so to speak, between the parties?
It should, Your Honor, and there are a lot of things that need to go back, but it should, Your Honor, because, frankly, Judge Adams, in the underlying matter, actually found it in favor of Renown as to reasonable value versus reasonable charges. That's the part that's just baffling about the order that is as entered. In Judge Adams' oral pronouncement, at the conclusion of our hearing, he actually found in favor of Renown that reasonable value is different than reasonable bill charges, and that Renown may be entitled to its full undiscounted amount for the hospital lien. So for that reason alone, yes, Your Honor, it should be remanded back because it's in, the order as written is inconsistent with Judge Adams' oral pronouncement.
Why should we remand it back, Mr. Nork? This is here on cross motions for summary judgment, stipulated facts. What would be remanded? Why shouldn't this court address the legal questions that have been pretty thoroughly evaluated on this?
And that was my initial comment to Justice Cherry, which is that I believe that this court can, based upon the facts, issue an order. Now, obviously,
one of your arguments is that the breach of contract cause of action, I think it's the fifth, and the breach of interference of contract, I think it's the eighth, was improperly addressed by the trial judge, but you folks have pretty thoroughly evaluated it in the writ petition before us now. Why shouldn't the court reach, this court reach those, since the whole shebang is here on stipulated facts?
Well, you're right, and from Renown's perspective, you're absolutely correct. This court can view the stipulated facts, view the applicable law, and reach a decision. From Wiley's perspective, however, a win for Mr. Wiley necessarily results in a remand back to the trial court.
Anyway. Well, yeah, I just, my part of my question had to do with what seemed to be a kind of an odd set of stipulated facts. So that it takes me back to the question that I had before. So footnote one of the stipulated facts says the purpose of these stipulated facts is solely to allow the court to render a threshold decision on the legal issues in this case. Then this sentence, the parties agree that they are not bound by any of the stipulated facts in this document and may dispute any of these facts at a later stage. It certainly appears to me that this pleading asked the trial judge for an advisory opinion and similarly would be asking this court for an advisory opinion. Perhaps the court should reject the petition altogether as to all rulings because this sentence appears in footnote one. What say you on that? And I want to ask Mr. Peterson the same question.
I
think we're all here wasting a bunch of time if that's your sentence, if that's your stipulation.
Valid point, Your Honor. And my response is as follows. From Renown's perspective, under these stipulated facts, given the statute, we believe that dismissal of the plaintiff's underlying case is proper.
Well, my question to you and to Mr. Peterson is this. Do you both agree to withdraw the second sentence of footnote one of your stipulated facts?
I would agree, Your Honor. I would absolutely.
Good to know.
I'm sorry?
Good to know.
And
don't you,
I
mean, seriously, don't you think that, I mean no disrespect to counsel in the in what you're attempting to do, and I can appreciate the point that you're trying to resolve a threshold important question before you get carried away in a lengthy and expensive class action case. So my question is not intended to be disrespectful in any respect, but that sentence raises the specter that this is really just an advisory ruling, because there might be facts that the parties would point to in future stages of the litigation that would simply say, we're not going to rely on this. The ruling that you made, trial judge, and what I'm concerned about here, the ruling you made, Supreme Court, is improper or unreliable or advisory because it rests on facts which we later now see weren't correct.
I think, Your Honor, addressing the facts to the law, the trial court and this court can enter a decision that is binding upon the parties. The intent, I believe, of that second sentence was, for example, if the dollar amount is off and if we're talking about damages, for purposes of the motions for summary judgment, for purposes of the petition, it does not matter whether or not the undiscounted amount was $21,000 or $31,000, mm-hmm. nor does it matter whether the amount of the discounted amount was $13,000 or $9,000. That doesn't matter for purposes of summary judgment. I think that the trial court could have ruled upon the legal viability of Mr. Wiley's claim, regardless of the mathematical precision of those numbers. The concern, obviously, was if the court denied summary judgment and we moved forward and we started talking about dollars and cents and damages and things of that nature, the parties wanted to have the ability to say, well, it said it was 32 cents and it was in fact 31 cents. That, Your Honor, was the intent. It was not to seek an advisory opinion, because I think that the broader issues addressed in the cross motions do not require that precision.
Mr. Nork, let me ask you another question. I'll give you a little more time, too, because we've eaten up a bunch of your time. In thinking about this case, just theoretically, and I was thinking about it in terms of that Tri-County versus Klinke case, and the concurrence in that case said it should be, the plaintiff should be entitled to admit the amounts billed as opposed to the amounts paid. So that's an open issue as far as the majority of the court. But this is kind of a reverse of that here. You know, it could from the, I'm thinking from the plaintiff's standpoint, is it inconsistent to argue that you're entitled to the discount here, but you can try and ask for damages on the amount that's billed versus the amount paid? Do you have any thoughts on that?
That's our equitable estoppel argument, Your Honor, which is that on one hand, they use our full undiscounted amount to go to the third-party tortfeasor's insurance company and say, we want our settlement based upon that undiscounted amount, and then went to the hospital and said, you're only entitled to the discounted amount, and the person who gets the difference would be Mr. Wiley. Mm-hmm. It was Renown's position that it's the third-party tortfeasor does not get the benefit of a provider agreement that was negotiated between Renown and Cigna. And so that was the basis of our equitable stop argument. They cannot, on one hand, say, we want you, Renown, must send your full billed amount to Farmers Insurance, whereas you are bound by the discounted amount at a later date. That was our position.
Great. Thank you.
I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
You may just go ahead, Mr. Justice Hardesty.
Mr. Nork, related to that issue, but more importantly related to one of the claims in the case, why doesn't the language in the insurance commissioner's bulletin limit the amount a hospital can seek under NRS 108.590. I recognize that the language in the statute refers to reasonable services, but isn't the hospital bound by what it can legally recover by virtue of the Cigna agreement?
As it relates to Cigna, yes, but I think the statutory scheme allows it to seek the non-negotiated, non-discounted amount against non-parties to that agreement.
So basically, your argument is the opposite to the issue that the Chief Justice just posed, that in effect the hospital should be allowed to seek reasonable services, as a plaintiff in a personal injury action can seek regardless of whatever discounts exist.
That is certainly the case when there is a third-party tortfeasor who is responsible in whole for the injuries suffered by the insurer. Yes, sir.
Mr. Norton, we have 3 minutes in rebuttal. You had about 30 seconds, so let's add 2 minutes to Mr. Peterson's time. I think it'll pretty much equalize the time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bill Peterson for Stella Wilmer on behalf of the respondent here in this case. I had a whole presentation ready, but I'd like to respond to some of the questions that were raised first, but not in the exact order that they were asked. First, with Justice Hardesty, I will similarly stipulate to that. I asked that identical question of my co-counsels, who actually did most of the work in the trial level, other than arguing a motion, which was me. Why did we do this? The answer was it was insisted upon by Renown. But here was going to be my response, because I expected that question, which was whether or not they're binding or non-binding doesn't make them any less material or less undisputed with respect to cross motions. So therefore, you can consider it on that basis regardless of whether it's binding or not binding. But we have always, they are undisputed. They are true facts in the world, in the real world, and we deem them to be binding. And otherwise, they're material and undisputed. To answer Justice Cherry's question, I similarly thought of that because one of the arguments made by the hospital here is that the judge went off the reservation. He was supposed to confine himself to a narrow set of issues, and he went ahead and decided a whole bunch of issues. That argument is really defeated because if you actually read portions of their motion and our motion and the oppositions to those motions that you will see, and I'm quoting basically from those, is and this is a heading on Renown's own motion for summary judgment. Renown is entitled to seek its standard rates from Farmers for the medical services it provided to Wiley as a result of the tortfeasor's negligence under Nevada law. Our opposition is this. The issue raised in this case is whether a patient with health insurance who receives services from a network provider which has entered into a contract to provide services to the insured is entitled to the contractually accounted rates or discounted rates when he is a victim of a tort with access to third-party recovery. And that also was repeated in our motion and in their cross motion. So what was presented to Judge Adams, although he's been criticized for deciding that very question, is that he didn't confine himself to the narrow issues presented, which was basically the two lien statutes. But he was invited by both parties to decide basically the issue that I've just raised. The question that Justice Gibbons asked is, you know, with respect to the, I'll call it the reciprocal nature of the plaintiff asking for reasonable value in his tort claim, but not allowing or claiming that the hospital is not entitled to assert in its lien only the contract amounts. First of all, it's a totally different issue, because this court has already decided in Klinke that the collateral source rule would permit the plaintiff to recover the amount that was billed, the reasonable value of the services. Whether that's fair or not.
Yeah, I don't think that's been decided completely. I think in Klinke it was a statutory exception which allowed collateral source evidence in on these payments and talking about the amount paid. But be as it may, what's your thoughts on the analogy?
Well, here's my thoughts on that, and I'm not inventing this because your question has actually been decided or analyzed by the California courts. In particular, there's a case called Nikihama, which I have, and I'll give you that site. Co-counsel will find it here in this package, which was cited by the California Supreme Court in Parnell. Parnell actually decided the very issue presented to this court. They tried to, this is the California Supreme Court. The plaintiffs are attempting to distinguish Parnell by saying, well, Parnell, the statute in Parnell said the reasonable value of the charges, And the Supreme Court said, well, charges to whom? The answer is obviously the charges to the patient. And then the court says, well, the reasonable value of the charges to the patient are the charges to the patient, and therefore you may not file a lien for more than the amount that you've actually charged to the patient. Our lien statute, they try to distinguish it. Well, ours is the reasonable value of the services, but they omit what I consider to be even more compelling language in our lien statute, because the whole preface to the reasonable value is reasonable value of the amount due. So it's the same question that the California Supreme Court asked. Charges to whom? Amount due from whom? It has to be the patient. Nikki Hama, which is quoted in Parnell, answered your question, because there it was exactly the almost the reverse, where the plaintiff was saying, the plaintiff, Nikki Hama, is 93 Calap 4th, 298. It is cited in by the California Supreme Court in Parnell and extensively relied on Parnell. In fact, Nikki Hama is the one that came up with the analysis. But what the argument there to the court was by the plaintiff, you can't hold me to the amount charged in my tort claim, because the California lien statute allows the hospital to get the reasonable value of the charges. Therefore, if they can collect it from me in the third-party tort recovery, you must provide a mechanism whereby I can get it in my tort case. What Nikki Hama Court did, again, approved by Parnell, is they said, no, that's not right. And the reason it's not right, and they gave several reasons, and they all apply here. One is they said, just like the Supreme Court in Parnell said, charges. The lien says charges, reasonable value of the charges. Well, the charges, again, to whom? Has to be the patient. They also said, and in addition, the collection of the foreclosure of the lien is limited by the language of the statute to liable to the hospital. In other words, if they pay somebody, don't pay the hospital, repudiate the lien, liable to the hospital for the amount or part thereof which the hospital was entitled to receive. And so the court said, entitled to receive from whom? Entitled to receive from the patient. You are not entitled to more than what you charged the patient. Therefore, it is wrong to say that the lien statute allows the hospital to recover the reasonable value. They may not do so for the very same reasons that apply in our statutes, because ours are for the amount due, and ours foreclosure statute says you can't get more than what the hospital was entitled to receive from the patient. It is also made clear in the lien statute itself, the notice that was filed, in the form of notice of the lien, which they have to provide under 108.620, they have to follow the statutory form. The statutory form has a provision in it where you fill in the blanks. And the last thing it says in the statute, which they must fill in, there is now due and owing and remaining unpaid of such sum after deducting all credits, the sum of blank. Well, you ask yourself, this is 108.620, if the lien statute requires them to fill in the amount that is now due and owing, how can that be anything other than the amount that is now due and owing from the patient, which cannot be more than the amount of the contract that it entered into the hospital for that amount?
Mr. Priest, can I ask you one other question? Why do you feel Mr. Wiley qualifies as a third-party beneficiary and have standing to assert this claim?
All right. The There are many answers to this question, but to me, the one that is the most obvious is, if you look at what this arrangement is, we are dealing with an ERISA plan, and I know that there's not ERISA litigation, much of it, in state court. But this is an ERISA plan document where the benefits are provided by a plan fiduciary, which is FedEx, and the plan administrator. This is a wholly funded plan by FedEx. There's no insurance here. FedEx's plan. They totally fund it with their own funds and with the funds from, paid by Mr. Wiley and other FedEx employees. They pay into it. The plan document, which is in the record here, is, as I said, an ERISA plan. The plan fiduciary is a party to this contract, which is Cigna, which is the plan administrator for the FedEx plan. And, of course, the payor under the plan is FedEx. They're identified in this very contract as FedEx. And in addition to that, there is a service agreement in the plan, in the contract with Cigna and the hospital, which plaintiff has, on page 62 of its own brief, has stated is the FedEx beneficiary plan, the FedEx ERISA plan. So therefore, what we have here is a provider that enters into a contract with a plan fiduciary, a trustee, for the express benefit of the employees. It is preposterous, in my view, for anybody to argue that the participants defined in the plan as the plan beneficiaries, the benefit plan defined in this contract with the hospital, says benefit plan is for the benefit of the participants, for anybody to argue that the plan isn't for the employees who paid their money to FedEx, who also paid money in order to procure discounted services for the employees. That's why they are unequivocally third-party beneficiaries.
Okay. Thank you.
The question for me is, I want to answer it even if you haven't asked it because you may think of it later, which is, well, what about the provision that says there are no third-party beneficiaries in the contract? There are also multiple answers to that. In my view, the employees, am I finished?
No, you have 5 minutes.
The employees are basically almost parties to the plan. And here is one reason why. And if there is nothing else that you take away from my argument, this is what I would like you to understand and know. That in the plan document, there are two provisions on two different pages, which basically tells the employees, and this is common, it's probably common to all of you, tells the employees, if you go to a network provider, which is renowned, you don't need to worry about filing a claim, because they are going to file the claims for you. You don't file the claims. They file the claims for Mr. Wiley. The plan document then says the contract with the party. This is on page 1735 of the appendix, which is the service agreement in the contract. You don't have to file a claim when you go to a network provider. Your provider files the claim for you. What happens then, and by the way, the contract with Renown and Cigna requires them to file that claim. They must file that claim. They must file that claim because it is the plan administrator, the fiduciary under the plan, that has the sole, under the plan, the sole and exclusive right to make final determinations of coverage or non-coverage or whether there's a secondary payer or a primary payer. What should have happened in this case, and we wouldn't have a case if they had done this, if they had filed that claim with Cigna, which they did not do and did not want to do because they knew that what Cigna would do is exactly what Cigna did do. They got the claim because Wiley sent it to them. When Wiley got the $21,000 bill, he said, like anybody would say, why aren't you billing my insurance company? They refused to bill his insurance company under the contract. So what he does is he sends it to Cigna. It says, here's a bill I got from Renown. What does Cigna do? They pay it. They pay it. And then what do? They assert a subrogation claim against Mr. Wiley for the amount they paid under the plan, $13,000. That is what was supposed to happen. It did not happen the way it was supposed to happen because they, although they are supposed to file the claim under the plan document for Mr. Wiley, and because they did not file the claim as they're required to do under the contract, so Cigna can make these determinations, not them, we're here in this court. That's a long-winded way of telling you why I'm 100% sure they are third-party beneficiaries of this contract. There are several cases that I can cite to you where there are similar. One is the Dora case, where the same issue was raised in the Dora case, cited in the briefs. Third-party disclaimer, the court said, no, it doesn't matter what you say, it's what they are. And I'm going to give you one other case where this is Twin City Construction versus ITT Industrial, similar case, 358 Northwest 2nd, 716. And other cases which actually undertake the analysis, where the court says, look, to whom are the promises owed? Never mind what you say, what's actually happening here? Never mind how you categorize something. What is it in fact? What is it in reality? We examine the contract in order to determine where the benefits are going and who's owed what promises. In this case, the benefit goes to Mr. Wiley. The promises go from Renown to Mr. Wiley. We will file your claim. They make that promise to Wiley, and they make that promise to FedEx. We will file your claim. The last thing that is most important, is Renown doesn't get to decide whether it's covered or not. FedEx gets to decide, and Cigna gets to decide whether it's covered or not. One last point, if you're
go ahead.
If they decide, here's how ridiculous and stupid this whole thing is. If they put themselves in a position of deciding whether or not a claim is covered or not covered, as they say they are doing, they are plan fiduciaries. You are a plan fiduciary if you undertake those kinds of decisions for and on behalf of plan participants. And the plan in and of itself under ERISA law expressly says in two different places, this plan is for the benefit and shall be construed for to give you benefits.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Norick.
I'll try to use my 3 minutes wisely, but I would like to start by pointing out that what you've witnessed is kind of a continuing trend in this matter, which is, by my count, we've got four new arguments raised in the oral argument on this appeal. We had new arguments raised in the oral argument in the underlying case in the summary judgment. We had new arguments raised in Mr. Wiley's answer. We had new arguments raised in Mr. Wiley's supplemental briefing. This case has been briefed, I think, 300 pages now, and yet we keep getting new arguments, none of which, I might point out, have any merit.
These were not raised at the trial court level?
The Nikihama case was never raised at the trial level.
How about the argument itself as opposed to the case, though?
It was not. The only argument that was raised at the trial level was Parnell. The lien language is a new argument that was not raised at the trial level, and certainly the plan being an ERISA plan may have been argued at the trial level, but I should point out it was not part of the stipulated facts. The plan is not. It was not part of the stipulated facts. And then certainly the Twin Cities case is a new case. But I wanted to respond
to the question regarding the bulletin that was asked on my initial question. I couldn't find the specific language of the bulletin, but I have since been able to locate it. It simply says that the insured is not responsible for amounts above the contracted rate. Right. The Renown is not seeking to collect it from the insured. It's seeking to collect it from a third-party tortfeasor, and that's one of the reasons why we identified it not being applicable. The attempts to rely upon the language in Parnell by Mr. Wiley's counsel, again, there's an important distinction between reasonable value and reasonable charges. And the argument being made is, well, yes, it says reasonable value of amount due, and therefore that must be the billed amount. But there's no support for that argument. In fact, the only support is the contrary, which is what we have cited in our briefing, which is reasonable value is a quantum merit type of analysis and can extend to the full undiscounted amount.
Mr. Nork,
yes,
does NRS 449757 subparagraph 1 establish or dictate the order in which a hospital is to initiate billing when a patient has health insurance, as this patient did, but also has a claim against a third-party tortfeasor, as this patient does?
Language in that statute says that a hospital may not make efforts to collect. That's the language. And the question, therefore, is the recordation of a hospital lien an effort to collect? We rely upon the estate and Ulmer case that we've cited in both our petition and in our reply that suggest that a recordation of a hospital lien is not an effort to collect. Moreover, the language of the lien itself at the very bottom says this is a lien not against the insured, but rather against a third-party tortfeasor, and it is a lien against any proceeds to be paid. They have not been paid. So the short answer to your question is, yes, it outlines steps that must be taken, but we're not going to violate those steps by recording the hospital.
Take 1 minute and you can wrap up.
Your Honor, honestly, I don't see how this, barring a de novo review and granting summary judgment in favor of Renown, the order needs to be cleaned up. It has to be cleaned up. There are so many errors factually, legally, things that don't reflect the pleading. It has to be reversed and remanded. If this court is not willing to grant summary judgment in favor of Renown as the third-party beneficiary provision, I think that is a very strong argument. And counsel's attempt to claim a third-party beneficiary by being, and my quote was, almost parties to the agreement, that doesn't fly. And I think we've cited case law that suggests that being an almost party to a document that does not allow third-party beneficiaries does not allow you to enforce that provision. Barring that, the order needs to be cleaned up, Your Honor, and I would ask for a reversal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. Again, excellent arguments and briefs. We appreciate it from the amicus brief as well. It was submitted, and we will take this case under submission.